Welcome to Vashon 250. As America observes its 250th birthday, Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum have partnered to create our own recognition of this important milestone. I'm John Flora, and I'm joined by my colleague, resident historian, Bruce Holman. Welcome to Vashon 250 and episode number 21, Thomas Paine's Common Sense from January 10th, 1776. Today we're looking at the publication of Thomas Paine's Common Sense, a single 47-page pamphlet, the 18th century equivalent of a paperback book, did a lot to quickly shift American sentiment toward independence. Its author made an eloquent argument that Americans had a unique opportunity to change the course of history by creating a new sort of government in which people were free and had the power to rule themselves. Common Sense managed to go viral, using a modern term, selling an estimated 500,000 copies, a number that would be amazing even today. Colonial population was just 2.5 million, so the publication reached 20%, or likely more, of the colonists. And by the way, it's still available on Amazon today, free shipping with Prime membership. So who was Thomas Paine? Well, he was born in 1737, tried and failed at several occupations, including as a British tax collector. He lobbied for higher wages for himself and his colleagues, but failed and ended up with a very dim view of the British system of government. Along the way, he met Ben Franklin in London, who ultimately helped him get to America. He landed in Philadelphia in 1774, where he landed a job as a journalist. The colonies were already revved up in opposition to Britain's attempts to impose new taxes and to restrict trade, and he ultimately concluded that these folks are ripe for a revolution. In 1775, with the encouragement of Franklin and Benjamin Rush, the physician and activist who became a signer of the Declaration of Independence, Paine began writing Common Sense that would urge Americans to go beyond merely resisting British authority. With that introduction, we are joined by Brian Long, who is channeling Thomas Paine for us today. And he's going to discuss the importance of clear, direct, and understandable language. So welcome, Mr. Paine.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's very good to be here. I got my horse tied up outside. It's the next day. So very, very pleased. You mentioned my failed careers, and I did in England have, it was unfortunate. But I must say that as a tax collector, it wasn't so much that I failed, it's that I was too honest. And I wrote a pamphlet there decrying how poorly paid the tax collectors were and how they necessitated taking bribes. And that was not well received by the powers that be, so I was fired. But nonetheless, it was an unfortunate time in England, and I was very pleased to come to the American colonies, to Philadelphia in 1774, and did get some work writing in a magazine and managing Philadelphia Magazine, which was very good. And
So I had a question, Thomas. At a time when language was rather florid in our terms, you developed a style of writing that was very clear, very direct, very understandable by people who were not particularly well-educated but could read. You know, how did that happen? How did you get that sense of being able to write for the common person?
Because I was a common person. Because in England, I grew up lower working class, lower middle class, and understood the tyranny of the aristocracy and the classist society that we were in. So in many ways, it was simply my way of speaking and my way of writing. However, it also was certainly a departure from the more literary style than common among writers, and I think that had much appeal for the populace, particularly in the rural townships.
Today we have television programs, or streaming programs, I guess we would call them, on things like Netflix, and so like we have Pull Dark and others that highlight how the British Parliament worked and how the system worked and who had voting rights and who didn't. Mm. It's easy to understand why you might have gotten frustrated with that.
Indeed, indeed. And, you know, there was no written British constitution in the way that we understand it today. There was just a collection of different documents and customs and precedents. And so it was rather confusing. Yes. But I think it's fascinating to think about why My Common Sense had such an impact. It was well written, I must admit, but I think more largely than that, the populace was ready for this in an extreme way. And to understand it, you kind of have to understand a little bit that the society then was not the same as society now. I mean, 90% of the American colonists, the European American colonists, lived in rural townships, and they were largely cut off much of the time from the cities. So they were very self-reliant. And I think that set in mind, I opened Common Sense with a discussion of society versus government, which today we think of the Great Society. We think of, you know, the society and government is kind of blended together. But to the rural townships of the 1700s, we had the aspect of self-reliance. They saw themselves as that society that took care of each other. And government was something imposed from beyond, necessary evil to, you know, restrict our actions should they become predaceous.
So, Thomas, you know, Common Sense doesn't really have any new ideas in it. It's really a compilation of ideas from the Age of Reason that had been floating around but had never been expressed coherently and together like you did.
Indeed.
How did you do that? How did you pull together all these disparate strands of Enlightenment thinking into one great document?
I think it was... my life had led to that, and my philosophy had led to that, but I did craft Common Sense consciously in a flow where I opened rather modestly talking about society versus government, but then I absolutely excoriated and tore apart the idea of hereditary monarchy, which no one had dared to do. I mean, until it was treason, clearly, and people were now fighting against British forces. There was armed conflict, but it was still, most people, bear in mind, everywhere there was kings. That was the norm, except for the Dutch Republic, which I mentioned in Common Sense. There was kings. So people naturally thought there had to be a king or a ruler of some kind. And so they focused their ire on Parliament. But then the king came back with declaring them in rebellion. So now we weren't terribly keen on the king, but still to say we wanted to have independence, not that many people were willing to say that out loud in the taverns, over a beer perhaps, but not out loud in public. And I said it out loud and in public, and I said that the monarchy as a whole makes no sense. It's outrageous. And I think that was so shocking. I can imagine the conversations over cups of ale in the taverns where people are laughing and in response to this. And essentially every colonist read this or had it read, because it would have arrived into the township in somebody's saddlebag and immediately started making the rounds and being discussed in the taverns, in the churches, in the town meetings. Reading aloud, and then as many copies as they could get their hands on. So that sensationalist aspect of the paper punctured a bubble. It popped the bubble of that we have to have a monarchy, that we have to make up with England. And thus, I could openly say, look, it only makes sense. How could England rule a nation almost as large and soon to be larger than them from 3,000 miles away? It didn't make sense. And I think that common sense aspect of it was new to the people It was in their minds, in the air, as it were. But my pamphlet, as they say, was the touch that struck the string.
Sort of the, if you will, the fuse that lit the powder keg.
Indeed.
So I'm just curious, from a practical standpoint, you published 500,000 units, allegedly, or thereabouts.
In that first year, it was more like 120,000. But there was only 2 million people in European colonists. Bear in mind, even the cities. Philadelphia was the largest city, and that was 40,000 people. Barely a town in South Dakota now. So it reached essentially everyone above the age of 16, I think.
How did you print it?
Oh, well, I contracted with a printer who just started running off copies. No surprise there. A publisher printer. And initially, I published it without my name attached. But it soon became known who had written it.
Did you also have a list of speaking engagements where you talked about this? Or did you just leave the written word to do the work?
Well, in that, outside of Philadelphia, I was, in those days, there was no radio. So, no, I did not have much direct speaking except to, in the taverns and bookstores of Philadelphia. I did, have my conversations.
And did you have a sense when you left Britain of what your arrival in the New World would be like?
No idea. Okay. No. I got off the boat very, very sick with typhoid fever, and took me quite a while to recover. And then I had to find some work, and Benjamin Franklin had been so good as to provide me a letter of recommendation, and so I did procure employment with a magazine. But I had no idea. I mean, arriving in 1774, in the thick of the events of that year, the tension in the air was palpable. I knew there was something happening, and it was in discussions with Benjamin Rush, a dear friend that I met in a bookstore, yay for bookstores. And he encouraged me to put these thoughts down. And a bit of an opportunist, I did.
That's the way it usually works.
So Thomas, talk a little bit about the importance of it being read in taverns and churches and town meetings and those kind of things. And George Washington had it read to his troops during the winter, I think, at Morristown, that winter of 1776. So talk a little bit about that. And why do you think it became such a popular sort of thing in the public sense?
Right. Well, everyone was literate. Every home had a Bible, and everyone learned to read so they could read the Bible. And yet, there was not so many copies published that everyone could have a print copy. So as it arrived in town, these communities, much more tightly organized than we have community today, and they operated in a way to collectively process new information and news. So this pamphlet came in, and somebody started reading the intro, and like, this is interesting. And then they got to the part about the demolition of the idea of a monarchy, the legitimacy of monarchy, and suddenly they're going to be calling other people together and saying, hey, you got to see this, you got to hear this. So the places where people gathered were the taverns, were the churches, were the open-air markets, town meetings. And at any of those places, you would likely have somebody reading from Common Sense. And I think one of the things that hooked them right off, in addition to putting down the legitimacy of the monarchy, was I did that by quoting the Bible extensively. The book of Judges and the book of Samuel make it explicit that the Lord Almighty did not approve of kings. And I think that sent everyone immediately scurrying to their Bibles, and that would have initiated a lot of discussion. So that collective process could allow the emergence of a collective opinion that, you know, this guy's right. It's common sense. It makes no sense to continue. We are already at war. We would do this just to then get some taxes repealed and go back to the way we were. That makes no sense. We should move on to independence. We have the resources to do it. We are too big for other countries to conquer, and our population is doubling every 25 years. So independence only makes sense.
So we're going to have you back in a couple of weeks to talk about your series of pamphlets called The American Crisis.
Yes.
In which you develop these ideas more fully.
Yeah.
But part of this was essentially part of common sense, not only appealed to religion and religious sort of opposition to monarchies, but also had within it this concept of the age of reason and the Enlightenment, sort of deism, and a sort of move away from sort of slavish sort of adherence to any particular religion and more of a concept of the spirituality of religion.
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I, you know, my personal views on that are quite strong and were expounded upon in a later work of mine, The Age of Reason. But at that time in America, it would not do to put down religion. But America was founded on diverse religious sects having their independence and not being told what to believe and how to operate their religious institutions by the crown. So it was very important. The ministers and clergymen of America were on both sides of the argument. The Anglican Church more towards loyalty towards the crown and authoritarianism, and the Congregationalist and others more focused on freedom. But yeah, again, not that many people had taken the step to say, oh yeah, independence, right? But once it was said out loud, it all made sense.
So with that setup, let's move forward to modern history. During the last 250 years, there have been a number of times pamphlets and publications have shaped the future of the United States. What are some of the most significant of these historic publications?
Thomas, maybe you can talk about, I mean, one of the most important, of course, is the Declaration of Independence, and it's a direct line from common sense to the Declaration. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Yes, I think this was a discussion. I put forth a framework in common sense, a very brief sketch of what a republic could look like. And I think this was in people's minds of a fear. If we get rid of the king and we declare independence, what comes next? Who takes over? Who's in charge? It could be very messy. And so people were uncertain of what came next. I provided a sketch, but in assemblies through that year, there were more discussions along this line leading into the Declaration of Independence, which I had some hand in helping Mr. Jefferson in his work, but I don't get much credit for that.
the next big document to come along was the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, and of course, along with that, individual state constitutions. You make some specific arguments about how constitutions should work and how legislatures should work in common sense that become incorporated in those documents. Could you tell us about that?
They do become incorporated in some of them. I don't lay much claim to my originality in any of that. And there are others who perhaps were more instrumental. Also, there was a great diversity in those constitutions as they arose. And bear in mind, there was it 10 years between Common Sense or between the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. So quite a bit of time for things to develop. But I was pleased that the argument was generally around what kind of a legislature should be constructed, one house or two. And both were tried in different states.
The next big thing in my mind is the Gettysburg Address by Abraham Lincoln.
I was dead by then.
You were dead by then, but there's a direct line because at the end of the Gettysburg Address, Lincoln says that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from this earth. Those are almost direct words out of your mouth, you know, what, almost 100 years before that?
Yes, true. Again, I do not wish to be vain. I think,
however,
I think that the words I spoke in that regard echoed John Locke and other Enlightenment philosophers, that also informed Jefferson and other colleagues of the revolutionary time. And I think Mr. Lincoln very ably coined a phrase in that, which is a wonderful phrase that I think reflects back to that entire philosophical trend.
So at this occasion of the 200th anniversary of our country, we have a couple of issues in particular we want to talk about, and that would be the importance of learning knowledge and informed citizenry, and also the criticism of a power of monarchy. The No Kings movement would be the modern story. What do you have to say about that, Mr. Payne?
Interesting. I mean, you have in the 1770s in America this rural population, and bear in mind it would take 30 days or more to get any news from England or for news to go to England. It would take an equal amount of time to have news travel from Philadelphia to Georgia. And so we did not have the sort of up-to-date, minute-to-minute perspective that people have today. And perhaps that had some benefit. In that we could process things more fully at a slower pace. But we did it as communities. The communities informed themselves. Everyone was very involved in their community. So civic mindedness was focused on local issues. And then more remote issues such as that would nonetheless be critically important, such as the war with England, were handled in a similar way. People wanted to have, they were used to self-determination, having their voice heard. That was fundamental to the philosophy in America, the philosophy of the colonialist in America, is that every man should have a voice. Now, not everyone agreed to that when it came to political voice. Many believed that only propertied individuals, landed individuals, should have the right to vote because they had more to lose, they were better educated, or some such nonsense. But I certainly promoted that every person had the right to a voice, and that would have resonated very strongly with the colonies in the more remote townships, which was where the bulk of the population was.
So when you say every person, what did you mean by that? Do you really include slaves and women and native people, or were you still talking about just a male population?
I actually did, in an idealistic sense, and put that forth, but in a practical sense, recognized that that was not happening in my time.
A bridge too far.
Yes.
So as we watch the clock tick here, let's look at Vashon and where we are and some of the things that have happened here. And I have to admit that on the laundry list of things that we have to talk about, a lot of them I've never heard of, which is maybe more my problem than anything, but
oh no,
I have something to learn.
No, and Thomas may have some good comments on some of these. I think in terms of what common sense relates to Vashon is that expression of sort of the independence and the necessity for independence. And you get that very early on in Vashon. One of the things I focus on is that in 1908, there was a map published of Vashon that had a big red strawberry right in the middle of the island. And it was sort of a promotional brochure, if you will, for the island about growing strawberries, but also the sense that Vashon had this sort of independent sort of source of income, this sort of agricultural sort of industry that was uniquely its own in the Puget Sound region. Not that strawberries weren't grown other places, because they were, but that Vashon was able to identify itself as the home of the big red strawberry. You also get, and many of you may remember, the 2023 Jeff Hoyt's recreation of P. Monroe Smock's radio broadcast from 1926 entitled It's Vashon Isle. And if you had a chance to attend that, it was just a hoot. But what you got was this sort of music man promoter kind of idea of Smock setting Vashon up as this sort of perfect place to come, start your farm, start your family, start, build a home, start an industry, whatever. And this was, this was 4 years before the Great Depression hit. And so it really was that sense of Vashon on the precipice, because in the 1920s, Vashon loses population. Vashon is affected by the Depression of the 1930s, long before it hits most of the rest of the United States. And so you get this sense of Vashon promoting itself. And then in the 1960s, you have the Jigsaw Plan. Vashon, for the first time, and this is sort of the common sense relationship to me, Vashon, for the first time, says, we want to plan our own future. And as a result of that, they developed this comprehensive plan that covers everything from schools to businesses to transportation to ferries to just everything related to the island. And out of that grows the Civic Assembly, which becomes the community council, the health center, grannies. I mean, there's a whole range of things that we take for granted today on Vashon that emerge in that 1960s, Jigsaw Plan. And then, of course, you have the 2000s sort of emergence of this concept of keep Vashon weird. Well, Vashon is weird. And of course, Thomas, how weird was America in the world that you were writing about?
It was quite unique. And I currently am still trying to figure out why I was reincarnated here on Vashon Island rather than in my adopted home of Philadelphia. And I think it is because there is something special about this community. I think that we are an independent community and a progressive community and a weird community. And I think that's got a lot going for it.
That's why we're all here.
Right. Weird in the best meaning of the word.
In the best sense of the word. Yes.
Well, Mr. Payne, it's been a pleasure having you. We look forward to seeing you again in a couple of weeks. And with that, we look forward to speaking with all of you in Radio Land again soon. Join us next week.
That's a wrap to this episode. Bruce and I invite you to join us again each week through the end of 2026 for interesting stories about our collective American and Vashon Island history. If you have a question, comment, or suggestions of a topic we might want to cover, please drop an email to vashon250@voiceofvashon.org. Vashon 250 is a production of Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum. Our producer is Truman O'Brien. Vashon 250 is sponsored by NACM Business Credit Services, a 126-year-old association focused on credit education and professional financial services for business credit departments across the nation. For more information, go to nacmbcs.org. We appreciate their support. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.